We couldn't protect a crime scene. We couldn't protect ourselves. The UN realized that it had quite a lot of corruption cases internally. They all rely on donor funding. And telling people you've got a problem, you know, nobody gets extra donor funding by putting their dirty washing on the line. I think they should do. And then I found out that a large number of heavily armed men were coming, and I'm not going to stand in the way.
Welcome to the latest Cognitas Global podcast. The theme being a life less ordinary, and I'm pleased to say I'm joined this morning by a man that I've known now for about 5 or 6 years, having done some work for his organisation. It's Mr. Philip Truitt, OBE, Executive Director of the Institute for International Criminal Investigations. Philip, welcome to our podcast.
Morning, Laurie.
As you know, Philip, what we try and do is give the public and interested people an insight into people's lives, where they've led an interesting life. I know from conversations that we've had that you have a particularly interesting life, mostly centered around working around international humanitarian law, human rights, and venturing into territory more familiar to me, fraud and corruption. But let's go back to the Institute for International Criminal Investigations, based in The Hague, an organization that I've been very privileged to have worked for and delivered some courses for you. Perhaps you can just give us an oversight of what that organization does, what it's currently doing, and the successes that you've been having.
Happy to do so. So the Institute for International Criminal Investigations, normally known as IICI, gets confused with the ICC, the International Criminal Court, but we work with them, but we're not part of them. We do essentially what it says on the tin. We train people how to do international criminal investigations, by which, in shorthand, we term war crimes investigations, although we do move into the world of human rights as well. We were initially set up 20 years ago to support the ICC and the tribunals at the time for Yugoslavia and Rwanda, really in recognition that this stuff is really difficult and no one teaches you how to do it. So what was happening was a lot of police officers turning up from their domestic lives who were used to dealing with a robbery, a rape, a murder, and suddenly being asked to deal with not just one murder, but 1,000 bodies in a grave. Not just a single rape, but a pattern of conflict-related sexual violence involving hundreds or thousands of victims. And nobody really understood how to do it at that stage. So United Nations and other bodies not having the budgets for it, they set up this organization. And that's what we do today. Most audience is war crimes units from the various national jurisdictions, the ICC, the United Nations, and increasingly civil society.
And of course, when we talk about a civil society organization or an NGO, how would you sort of phrase your organization, Philip? Because I know people use terminology differently.
Well, I suppose technically we're an NGO, a non-governmental organization. We're a charity, effectively. It's based in the Netherlands. But we're a charity that has a very low profile. We don't spend any time or money advertising ourselves. So basically, if you're in the world of war crimes, you know who we are. If you're outside the world of war crimes, you will have no idea because we're extremely bad at self-promotion. hence, I don't do a lot of this type of thing. So I'm confident that given the scale of your podcast audience, this will be my entire budget for the year based on that.
What can I say? joking aside, I think, you know, the perception is that you may be some big organization, but I know that actually you're not, but you do achieve some tremendous success and projects. You are reliant on donations and benefactors, of course. And I guess one of the biggest challenges for you is raising funds for the type of work you do.
It is. The problem is we, you know, what we do doesn't reflect a crying baby on the front of a report looking like they're starving. It's not a donkey that you can put on looking miserable. It's not the sort of thing that can press those emotional buttons. So there's not a lot of point in us putting out flashy reports, because what we do is we make people better at catching bad people effectively. But that doesn't boil down to a nice picture, and it doesn't boil down to a nice mission statement that fits easily within the average donor funder. So we have had donor funding in the past, but increasingly what we do is we charge people a fee. The organizations we work for, they pay a fee for our courses. I mean, it's not a lot compared to some of the corporate world, but it covers our costs and gives us a little bit extra to keep the lights on. But of course, we have to keep our costs as low as possible because quite a lot of people pay for their own tuition. Because the one thing the international community is very bad at is setting aside money for training people. I think their view is that people should, if they come to them as an investigator, they should know what they're doing. But as I mentioned earlier, when you come into this world, nobody knows what they're doing. And that's why we exist. So donors are great, but they're also quite hard work.
I've had an insight into the type of work that you do. And I've got to say, I mean, it is unbelievably shocking. I mean, people won't know the full extent of that. They'll see it on the news. But you're training people to go into areas of conflict, huge atrocities, and effectively manage the scenes, manage individuals, help people. What's the relationship between the work that you do or the success or the results that you're having in the international courts, for instance? If you perhaps could explain that and how that works in terms of bringing people to courts and the types of evidence that you're looking to acquire to bring people to court, or that you're trying to tell people to acquire in terms of your training courses.
The difference that people will find coming from a domestic jurisdiction into the international world is you're rarely looking at, I mean, if you're a policeman on the streets of London or Paris or whatever, you're generally looking at a single perpetrator and a single victim. That's what we're looking at. In our world, you're not. You're looking at multiple victims of different types, and you're looking at multiple perpetrators at different levels. So your direct perpetrator may be a sergeant who pulls the trigger, but the reality is nobody in the international world is interested in that sergeant. That's something that can be dealt with at a domestic level later on. They're interested in building a link all the way up to the top, to the generals, to the prime ministers, to the presidents, that sort of thing. And so it's really a very different mindset. And it can be a sort of quite industrial process in that you need to be going through lots of witnesses, but you're looking to build a pattern. You're really not terribly interested in the fact that the victim is Laurie Day. You're interested in the fact that Laurie Day is a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, a Catholic, or a civilian as opposed to a combatant. These are the sort of things. So it can be a little bit more industrial than you might see on a domestic level. Quantifying what we do is quite difficult in terms of quantifying the success, because we can't say we trained you, you put together a case and a bad guy went to jail, because the number of bad guys going to jail in our world is not actually very high. And drawing a direct link between the quality of investigations that we can help people achieve and that, it's dependent on too many other factors, political amongst others. But so we really gauge ourselves on the feedback we get. In other words, how people feel they've improved and how organizations see their people improve when we finish with them.
If you could just give an example of the type of scene that you might be facing or an investigator might be facing, the type of atrocities and the challenges, and then perhaps we could link that back to the course that you actually deliver, just to you know, people understand, you know, what it is that's required to go out and then manage some of these scenes. So painting the scene first, Philip, what would you expect to find in, I don't want to say a typical situation, but in some of the situations you've had in Libya and other places?
If we're talking about scenes as in, you know, what is a scene? Well, it could be a hole in the ground full of bodies. It could be a prison. It could be a classroom. You know, it could be anything. And it depends on the type of crime. If you're looking at something like conflict-related sexual violence, it could be a hotel where people have been kept. So I think you've got to sort of get out of your head what is a crime scene that you might have seen on the television with that's carefully managed, that's carefully controlled. You can't do that in the same way. You don't have the resources. You don't have police officers to stand guard. Sometimes it's possible. So you go back to the days of the Bosnia investigations with the Srebrenica graves. You have a series of graves with up to 7,000 bodies in them. You had S4 or whatever it was called at the time, the military assets available to protect that scene for a long period of time. So it could all be dug up. And the bodies removed and also all the evidence removed and processed and all the rest of it. If I take my own experience in Iraq, we were still in it wasn't even post-conflict. It was fairly well conflict, given the level of insurgency. So the idea that, you know, we couldn't protect a crime scene. We couldn't protect ourselves. You would have needed a battalion of troops, of combat troops to protect a scene for a period of time. It just wasn't going to happen. And those crime scenes there as well tended to be quite old. So the bodies had desiccated. There were very little flesh left on them. We're talking bones rather than than bodies. Libya and one of the others, a little bit of a combination of the two. So some, you know, visible sort of bodies, but also lots of bones and various other things. So it does vary, but, you know, that's one type of crime scene. The other type of crime scene is, you know, you walk in and it's a school. Now you believe it was used as a detention center, for example. It still looks like a school. What you're looking for is the sort of the details, not so much of necessarily physical evidence left behind, but you're looking to corroborate the witness testimony. In most cases, they're going to be built very heavily on witness testimony, because people like, well, me in my old days, but people like the ICC, it tends to be months, not months, but maybe years after the event. So the reality is any evidence you get is likely to be old. It's likely to be tampered with. So building the chain of custody, it's not as easy as it might be on a national level, and you don't have the resources. You don't have the guys in the white suits available to swoop down with their kits and start taking DNA evidence left, right, and center.
And how do you then relate that awful situation that you've got there? And of course, you know, if you go back to Srebrenica, then you've then got to deal with, during an investigation, people trying to compromise that, but I know they were shifting the graves and moving the bodies to avoid detection. So you've got all these additional challenges during a live situation. How do you then go back and assist the international partners to go and investigate that? So the course that you deliver, it's a 2 or 3 week course, isn't it? I think you take them out in the field, scene management. Just give us a bit of information about that and how that relates then to that type of that type of situation management.
Well, one of the big things you're going to have to manage is not just the scene itself, it's the area around it, because it's not just that there might be bad guys who want to interfere with your investigation. You've got families who want to know what happened to the people that they love. I'll give you an example from my time in Iraq. I turned up naive, young, enthusiastic, as I used to be, with the idea that we are definitely going to protect these graves. We're going to secure them. We are going to remove all the evidence. I got there, and by the time I got there to one particular place called Al Hilla, I was faced with several hundred or even thousand large clear plastic bags containing a variety of bones and documents, which the people who'd got there were basically picking up a skull and a bone that they found near an identity card. And it was like a jigsaw puzzle. So from an evidential perspective, it was useless, but that's what those families wanted to do. Another grave down in the south in Basra, I was determined to secure. And then I found out that a large number of heavily armed men were coming to repatriate the bodies back to the north of Iraq. And I'm not going to stand in the way. You know, you've got all the emotion of the families, and you don't have you can stand there, but how are you going to protect those graves? You can't do that in the same way as you do domestically, even if you felt you had the right. And, you know, what's to say my view of justice is the same as their view of justice? It doesn't trump their right to get their families back. But you've got to manage that. You've got to explain to them why you're doing what you're doing. And these aren't people who watch, you know, to television shows involving detectives. They don't understand about CSI Miami and Line of Duty and all these other programs. They just want their people back. And they can get quite angry as well. You know, you're there. What are you trying to hide? Why are you trying to stop us getting our people back? So there's that element. There's a political element where they're asking you, why are you investigating that grave and not investigating that grave? You're favoring that side over this side. You're biased. You know, you've got that to deal with as well. And then you've got to put together a group of international people who may all do things slightly differently. So they all come from different jurisdictions and they all do things in their own way. And they say, well, in Portugal, we do this. In Britain, we do this. In Australia, we do this. Well, we're not in any of those places now. We need to work out how we put together the best possible practice in this situation with a fraction of the budget, a fraction of the people. So the way we teach it is we say, don't worry about what you'd like to have. You haven't got it. Work with what you've got. It's very much old school policing. So basically you've got a notebook, you've got a pen, and you've got a nice camera if you're lucky, but otherwise let's get your phone out and let's start playing around with your iPhone or your Android or whatever, and just see, you haven't got 6 weeks to do this scene. You might have 6 hours. What can you achieve in that particular time? What is your priorities? You know, what do you really need to come away from this scene with? Are you able to actually not just collect the material in the correct way, but transport it and then later store it in a way that gives you a half a chance of getting it accepted by the jurisdiction you want it to be accepted by. If you can't, then your best thing is probably to leave it, take some photographs, document it all that way. So we're not talking about DNA testing or anything like that. We're talking about documenting crime scenes for our audience, and that's what that's what we call it. So we're going to do one in April. We're working with the Dutch military, who we do a lot with. They have a school of peace operations in that they train all of their peacekeepers and other audiences. And they're going to, we'll set up, for example, a mass grave. We'll set up a missile strike, for example, and where we'll be leaving behind the remnants of a drone or remnants of a missile. They'll be teaching people how to primarily search for it and then, like I say, document it. And if you're going to collect it in a way that's safe for you and keeps the evidence in the best possible condition.
And you can see the challenge there. You know, there isn't any one particular, maybe police force, army, that could really just go out and teach that as a standard course. What it needs is people that have been out there in the field, such as yourself, bringing all that experience together through international best practice, I guess, over many years, to put together what still really is always going to be an unknown situation when you get out there and you're on the ground. Where did this interest start for you? You're an undergraduate in a degree in law, MA in war studies. This whole topic must have grabbed you at some stage in your life, because I know you've been doing it for many years now. Where did that start for Philip Truitt?
I wouldn't say I grabbed it, because that would suggest I knew what I was doing. It sort of grabbed me the other way around. I needed a job. I got asked if I would go work for an organization that was actually working on Iraq when the days that Saddam Hussein was in power. And they were actually campaigning against the regime there. And it was something that was funded by the US Congress primarily. But it was at the time that General Pinochet got arrested here, if you remember. And Jack Straw, the Home Secretary at the time, was having to deal with the fact that he was arrested under a warrant from a Spanish magistrate. And so we suggested, well, why just campaign? Why not build some cases? And so we went and we found the best lawyers we could in various European jurisdictions. And we started doing what's today is called the concept of universal jurisdiction. In other words, when a country takes the right to prosecute somebody for a crime committed in an overseas jurisdiction, usually based on the fact that the victim is in the country, or the perpetrator turns up in the country. But in theory, you can prosecute people for crimes committed overseas, even if there's less of a link, depending on the jurisdiction. But we started working out what could we prosecute and where, and getting the best lawyers to effectively teach us how to do it. Because at the time, nobody knew how to do it. It was not something that anybody was doing. Police forces weren't doing it. Civil society at that time wasn't doing it. So we thought we'd try. And so we did it. And we made our mistakes. But at the time, when you get the best people telling you what best defense lawyers in various places telling you what do you need to do to beat them, you learn pretty quickly. So we, for example, took British police statements and we started following the procedure that they used to take a statement. So we knew that would be a best chance of getting accepted in a British court. If we were picking up a video in those days, we started following, British chain of custody rules for the video. I remember getting videos of press conferences and having to track down British BBC journalists who'd been at the press conference so they could authenticate an old VHS tape saying, I was there and I saw this individual say this. I mean, this is in the days before social media, in the days before open source investigations and everything else. But it was a tremendous learning experience. So I haven't had any very little formal training when we started. I mean, I had some since, but I'm a weird individual. I've do investigations. I'm not a police officer. I've got a law degree, but I'd never describe myself as a lawyer.
You charlatan, you.
Well, absolutely. It's when you have to go for your car insurance and it says, what do you do for a living? And I had no idea what to put down. But anyway, you muddle along is the idea. So that's how I ended up in, I spent 5 years wandering around the world interviewing, victims, but also defectors, lots of people coming out from Saddam Hussein's regime. So I spent a lot of time with difficult and unusual people in difficult and unusual places, which was a good training school for later on. I then, as you say, when I was asked by the British to go out to Iraq to help there, I'm not sure anybody was able to help there, but we all did our best.
I think one important thing that people, you know, also need to understand in context of what you do and what you've been doing is that you have no formal powers, as it were, no police powers, no jurisdiction in effect. So you rely on this ability to collect information, often perhaps without the assistance, the immediate assistance of law enforcement, requires a lot of lateral thinking. I've seen the way that you approach this. You try and train your investigators to think laterally and outside the box and to look at every opportunity to acquire evidence. So that's a really important thing, isn't it? That you're going into these places effectively just using your common sense and wits to acquire this evidence.
Yeah, there's no badge for doing this. There's no subpoena powers. Even something like the International Criminal Court relies entirely on national jurisdictions if they want to seize anything or they want to require any particular piece of information. They have to make a request for assistance. The same way that governments have to make MLA requests to other jurisdictions if they want a bank account or if they wanted to search a property. So the ICC doesn't have its own police force, as it were. Neither did any of the Yugoslavia Tribunal, Rwanda Tribunal, any of the United Nations human rights bodies. They don't have any coercive powers at all. They've really very little more than civil society. The only thing they do have is, you know, the willingness of states to help. And a little blue passport or laissez-passer, which might give them a little bit of a pull, shall we say, but not a lot. You also don't have anybody to protect you, really. You know, you've got a security officer, but it's not as if there's a SWAT team hanging around waiting to come in and get you. And so you're dealing with some very difficult people in some very difficult security environments. And you've got to keep your witnesses safe. You've got to keep yourself safe. And, you know, there's no ability to whisk your witnesses off to Florida to start a new life. No, it might be there in theory, but the reality is there's no budget for it.
Yeah.
And so it's just such a very difficult and different operating environment to anything that people are used to domestically. And I think some police officers who come into this world adapt very well, and some find it very difficult because they spend their time saying, well, back home we have X. Well, you're not back home. You're not in Kansas anymore, Dorothy. For those of you who of a certain age who remember The Wizard of Oz, it will get the reference. Quite. But it's not easy anyway.
And I think what people also need to remember is that the people that are out there working for NGOs are often doing this on a voluntary basis. They're not being highly paid. Their motivation is not financial. And as you say, they're putting themselves at great risk to try and, make the world a better place. That's not, you know, obviously what I mean, but to try and benefit a lot of people that have had tremendous injustice and been a victim of many atrocities. So, that was always never lost on me, the fact that, I was in Tanzania recently and just came across somebody that was two British people that were working against human traffickers. And, set up their own company, self-funded, very little funds, but are out there just doing this because it's a passion for them and they genuinely believe in what they're doing. So, as I say, you know, let's not forget that this isn't all about money, this type of work. This is far different, the motivation.
Yeah, and I mean, we don't work with many people who are volunteers, but the civil society work with is increasingly professional. I think if 20 years ago you'd asked police whether they would work with civil society, a lot of them would have looked at you horrified. Today, you know, the quality of some of the people we work with is very high. The quality of the work they're doing in some ways is higher than is being done by national jurisdictions. And, you know, I've just been working with a group. Half of them have left very prestigious New York and London law firms because they were bored of making money for corporations and wanted to do something a bit more meaningful. You're getting people who've been educated at Harvard and Yale and Oxford and Cambridge and everywhere else who are coming into the world because they want to make a difference. Yes, they don't get paid very much, but they are wanting to do a highly professional job. And our view is they're going to be on the scene far earlier than the United Nations or the ICC or national law enforcement in most cases. You know, your Amnesties and your Human Rights Watch, they send people to every conflict zone. So our view is if we can make them better, the quality of the evidence they get is better. The way they, the shape it gets passed on to law enforcement then is in, is better. And therefore the likelihood that the law enforcement use it to catch bad guys is going to be, increased. And so we, part of, you know, a big part of what we do is bringing those two worlds together, law enforcement and civil society, letting them learn from each other and hopefully improving both of them.
No, I think you're right. You know, many organizations are very parochial in their approach, but partnership working, no question about it, is definitely the way forward. And leveraging each other's strengths and skill sets is really the only way, you know, that you can truly achieve, you know, good results, operational effectiveness. And as I say, really, I think, you know, in the longer term, achieve success. So let's move on. You've left that world and you've gone into fraud and corruption as an investigator, I hasten to add, not as a perpetrator, with the European Investment Bank in Luxembourg. How did you make that leap and why and what was all that about?
Why was because they asked me. so again, I'm always reluctant to give anybody career advice because quite frankly, my career has been, to say the least, unplanned. I was in Baghdad and something came up called the oil for food scandal. Which was a big deal at the time. I don't think anybody will have heard of it now, but in essence, the United Nations put sanctions against the Saddam Hussein regime in Iraq, but they found a way around it in collusion with lots and lots of, well-known international corporations, as well as lots of well-known politicians. And they were using, oil allocations, cheap oil, to bribe politicians. And they were using, kickbacks effectively from, international companies wanting to supply goods to Iraq. Everything had to go through, the United Nations, but billions on offer. And as you know yourself, Laurie, whenever there's that amount on offer, people find a way around it. And so there's basically widespread corruption. And so they set up this investigation and they needed somebody who was capable of operating in Iraq. So somebody put my name forward and I'd never heard of the program. I knew nothing about it. But I thought, okay, well, let's take a look and, join probably the most, effective and highly skilled and experienced investigation group I'd ever been part of because there was no open recruitment. It was basically who do you know who's good and who do you know who's good to work with? And it was all word of mouth effectively. And so there were some amazing people, worked on that. Didn't achieve very much in the end because at the end of the day, despite having very solid evidence against lots of very well-known names, you can go back and look at the report. It's online if you want to see some of the politicians involved. They're all very well-known to people in this country and elsewhere. The international community did very little to prosecute people at the end, which actually so... While it's one of the most fulfilling things I ever did, it's also achieved very, very little, really. But one of the offshoots of that was that the UN realized that it had quite a lot of corruption cases internally. In other words, in international development, big development projects, internal corruption, and they at the time didn't have the ability to investigate it themselves. They didn't have the skill set. They had people who were used to dealing, you know, maybe small-scale frauds, people cheating on their expenses account, but they had no idea how to investigate, you know, a $10 million, $100 million project in a particular country that had been corrupt. And so they put together a task force and I was asked then to join that task force. And that led me for the next, well, I suppose 10 years or so in total through a variety of different UN agencies and finally onto the European Investment Bank, doing fraud and corruption investigations. With a brief break in between, go back into war crimes to go to Libya when the UN rang me up and asked me if I'd go back and do that for them.
Who can we find that would just go back to Libya and Iraq? Ah, Philip Truitt, he likes going back there. So.
Yeah, well, you should. My wife had just had a baby 6 weeks before I left, so she was less than thrilled.
I can imagine.
Yeah, so try talking about your miserable day in a mass grave to a woman with a 6-week-old baby who's not getting a lot of sleep, you're not going to get a great deal of sympathy from your from the home front, and perhaps rightly so.
No, I can imagine. And that must have been frustrating on that UN Oil for Food program, that that never really resulted in the convictions or the sanctions or the action that you required in the end, I guess, you know, for all the hard work that had gone in, into that.
To be honest, you can say the same thing about the UN fraud and corruption, in that you can do the best investigation you can. You can provide, you know, in many cases, we're able, despite having no coercive powers, we're able to provide pretty much court-ready cases based purely on what we were able to get through persuasion, charm, a little bit of arm twisting. And yet, unless the organization itself was prepared to take action, nothing happens. So my recommendations were always the same. Here's the bad guy. Here's what they've been doing. Here's where the money's gone. Here's who did it. You need to stop further funding to this immediately, and you need to hand this over to law enforcement and not give them any more money until they come back and tell you they've done a proper investigation and a proper prosecution. And the number of times that happened was almost never. What you find is a degree of embarrassment, which that all, and it's the same thing whether it's Oxfam or the United Nations, they all rely on donor funding one way or the other. And telling people you've got a problem, it's a little bit like going to a party and telling them you've got an embarrassing social disease. Everybody's going to move away from you. They're not going to crowd around you and ask you to talk more about it. That's how it seems to work a little bit. You know, nobody gets extra donor funding by putting their dirty washing on the line. I think they should do. I think if I was working for the British government and an agency said, look, we've got a massive problem. You know that project we had? It's been stolen, but here's what we're doing to make sure it never happened again. I'd be tempted to support them. But that doesn't happen, unfortunately.
Well, we could do another whole podcast on donor funding, I could assure you, but probably best not. Let's, as we move to the end of the podcast, Philip, and, as always, it's been a pleasure to speak to you. We come back, I guess, full circle to the IICI now, where you remain as the executive director. What's the future for the IICI? What would you like the future to be for the IICI?
Well, I think the future is fairly bright in terms that the demand for what we do is increasing. And that's not a good thing in terms of the world in some ways, because it means that bad stuff is happening. But it's a good news in the other ways, that more people are saying the way to do good investigations is not to hang around and hope you get good people sent to you. It's to actually train the people you have and make sure they do it better. So the fact is, we're developing relationships now with lots of organizations who are getting us to do repeat bespoke training for them, as well as the courses we do where people can apply to come. More and more agencies are coming and saying, create something specific for us. So we're not short of business, as it were. So from that perspective, we're going forward. We're expanding what we do. We need to be moving into different areas like drone warfare. If you'd asked anybody 5 years ago about drone warfare, they wouldn't have known what you were talking about, other than maybe an occasional Hellfire missile fired at a terrorist in Afghanistan. You look at Azerbaijan and Armenia, for example. You look at the Turkish destroying a Syrian armored division with drones. You look at what's happening in Ukraine. So we need to be adapting constantly for new types of warfare and new types of tactics while not losing those basic skills. So we'll be doing something on drone warfare. We'll be increasingly increasing our open source investigation offering. As you all know, we've been moving into financial investigations to give people another tool in the armory. If you can't necessarily show that a senior figure was present at a particular crime, can you show by the way the money was used that they knew about it or that they had knowledge of it? So we're moving into lots of different areas as well, and hopefully, you know, continuing to expand our offering. We're limited by the number of trainers out there. All our trainers are people who've done the job. So we are reliant either on people who've recently retired, or we also get a lot of organizations allow us to use people who are currently working for them because they recognize what we do and they like what we do and we have good relationships with them. But as long as we can get the capacity, we'll keep doing what we're doing.
And it's tremendous work, having worked with you firsthand, and knowing the programs you deliver. I know you sort of mentioned that you sort of stay in the shadows. You don't really do a lot of marketing. Your website is sort of fairly limited in the information it gives. But what I would say is, you know, we're very happy to promote the work of the IICI. We will do in the podcast with all the references on the video. I'd just like to say, Philip, thank you very much for spending some time with me this morning. As always, I enjoy speaking to you. It's been a great pleasure learning a little bit more about some of your background. And I'm sure that for those that aren't fully aware of some of the issues that go on in the world outside and how they're being addressed, that they're going to learn something from this podcast. So, Mr. Philip Truitt, OBE, thank you very much for your time this morning. And we'll meet again. Thank you.
You're very welcome, Laurie. Thanks a lot. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.